One nice thing about the future is it never arrives. We can speculate about computer domination and planet creation all we want, from a safe distance. In his book, A Brief History of Tomorrow, Jonathan Margolis says, people have been predicting the future for ages, but we almost never get it right. Still, doesn't stop companies like Britain's Orange from trying.
They're talking about having a cell phone effectively implanted in your ear as an ear stud, which will run your life. It will wake you up in the morning. It'll read you your emails while you're in the shower. It'll tell you what the traffic's like on the way to work. It'll arrange multilingual translated conferences for you while you're walking along the street or sitting on the train going to work. I think they've got it wrong. I don't think anybody wants that.
Well, it sounds a little like Big Brother as your servant, but still Big Brother.
Yeah. It's a lot like Big Brother. And there is an overexcited tendency. I'm just looking in front of me here to a report, one of our greatest, one of the world's most famous futurologists, a guy called Ian Pearson, who was saying publicly that by 2010, the world's highest earning actors and pop stars and models will be synthetic celebrity bots with artificial voice personality generated by a computer and so on. I would be tempted to say that won't happen. It may be possible for that to happen, although I even doubt that, but there is a consumer resistance.
There are other things where people seem to be fascinated with the idea of merging technology and our bodies. Is that really beginning to happen?
I don't think it's beginning to happen. I'd be a little surprised if it has. I was just reading a piece in one of our more sort of trend-oriented magazines, and it was saying that one of the coolest things for 2002 is not to be contactable, and gave a list of celebrities and big hitters in corporate life who don't carry a cell phone or a beeper or anything else, because it's a way of showing what a big cheese you are by being completely uncontactable.
Well, there are thousands of people all over the world who are already ahead of them in that.
Yeah, they're the people who've done it by never having had a cell phone in the first place. But beware of denigrating the importance of the cell phone in countries that never had a proper telephone network. I mean, all over the third world, cell phones are enormously important.
Well, and for a lot of people, it is still desirable to have that, is what you're saying. People want the ability to communicate.
But the further reaches at the kind of the urban extreme, becoming untouchable, unreachable, is showing signs of becoming something desirable again. So I think there will always be this pull against these personal, intrusive technologies. And one of the areas I think we're going to really rebel against is artificial intelligence. Now, we're told repeatedly to the point of boredom that by 2015 we'll have computers that are as intelligent or more intelligent and creative than human beings. Now, first of all, I think this is a gross example of what I call in the book the arrogance of the present. I think we hopelessly underestimate the human brain. I mean, no less an authority than Stephen Hawking has pointed out that the largest and most powerful Cray supercomputer in the world has the equivalent intelligence currently of an earthworm. And he suggested that by 2005, it might be approaching the intelligence of a mouse, the real intelligence. It does things fast, but it's not smart in the sense that we are.
But we have always worried, too, about those supercomputers and whether they will enslave us in the future. I mean, that's part of the apocalyptic vision, too, isn't it?
Yeah, and I don't buy it. Again, you know, look at robots. We are supposed to be in the age of robots now. They're supposed to be clanking and crunching around our homes, doing the dusting and making the coffee. And in a sense, they are. The average home has several robots working away, you know, turning the heating on and off, micro robots doing little chores, turning the washing machine on and off and up and down and so on. But as for the clanking, clunking, two-legged, bipedal headed version, there's just no call for it. If it did exist, it would be too creepy, really, to have moving around the house, doing things. Even though they've perfected, at last, a robot which can climb stairs, it couldn't even begin to climb stairs while holding a cup of coffee.
What about medical advances? One of the predictions that I know you wrote about was that at one point they thought there would be head transplants. Now, there are times when I'm tired of looking at myself in the mirror, but that's not a terribly appealing idea for most people, is it?
Well, yeah, but if I offered you a body transplant, you might feel slightly different. If I had an old, tired body that I, you know, was really rather fed up with, and somebody like, say, Mike Tyson had one going spare, I would be probably quite happy to to have my head sewn onto the top of it. You know, these are, they appear to be kind of comic book joke questions, but they're really not. You know what? The most extraordinary thing that happened in the 20th century was the extension of lifespan. The beginning of the century, lifespan was something like 43. By the end of the century, it was over 70. Those are international figures. But the fact that people don't regard themselves as old at 40 anymore, they don't regard themselves old at 50 or 60, is probably one of the most significant things we've done to ourselves as a species. Anybody over 34 or 35 is, I think, technically speaking, is the living dead. We're not supposed to live beyond that point, let alone have our first children at that point, as is now the norm in Western urban society. So, yes, medical advances have probably been the most remarkable of all. And yet, if I were asked to say what will be the shape of medicine in this coming century, I think you might see a very different kind of medicine. I was talking to somebody the other day who believes that placebo, the controlled use of placebo, in other words, drugs that aren't drugs, are going to be the big, big growth area. A lot of things that are now almost a bit way out will be demystified, not so much legitimized, but simply demystified in the next 100 years.
You know, one of the things we haven't talked about is that, you know, almost all of the predictions about the future that you look at from 50 years ago or 100 years ago, there was a lot of talk of outer space. You know, 40 years ago, we talked about picnicking on the moon. And somehow outer space has, it's receded.
It's receded, and yet I found nobody in all my researches on the future, nobody who didn't feel that moving our sights out to the outer planets and outer galaxies would not be the core of the future. I mean, it seems to be a given that we will continue the exploration of outer space. And I've predicted in the book, for example, that this will carry unthought of social implications. Say the Americans or somebody establishes a base on Mars, as everybody says they will. And, you know, slowly we're working towards that. It's easy to get impatient, but it's kind of happening bit by bit. Say there's then a generation born on Mars. I see a kind of a similarity with the beginnings of the United States, where we had the Boston Tea Party, when suddenly the people born in the USA, or we'll say for the purpose of this argument, the Martian Americans, they'll accept that they came to be on Mars because of the efforts of the American taxpayer. But why would they want to carry on paying their taxes back to Earth? Maybe they're going to start thinking like post-colonialists and want independence from the Earth. You know, it's not their fault. They didn't ask to be born on Mars. They just were. There are also fascinating things that could happen because of the lower gravitational force on Mars. You know, the way on submarines people eat really well. It's always been part of submariner life, is that you feed the sailors really well, because it kind of, you know, it combats the boredom of being underwater for months at a time. You could eat whatever you like on Mars. It wouldn't matter how fat you got, because you'd only weigh half or a third what you weigh on Earth. So I can see a generation of fat and rebellious Martian Americans in 100 years from now.
Do you have a favorite prediction for the future? I mean, you've looked at a lot of them by now.
Favorite prediction for the future? Yes, I think one of the fun things that's going to happen, or funny things that's going to happen over the next 100 years, is an increasing premium is going to be placed by the middle class, the literati, the intelligentsia, on anything kind of handmade and real, as manufactured products become cheaper and better and more reliable. I think we're all going to want to have spots on our organic apples and badly made plates with finger marks in the glazing. And it's a sort of a Joni Mitchell vision, really, from the big, was it, which song was it that she celebrated, you know, give me spots on my apples, but leave the DDT alone, the beginning of the sort of organic movement. I think we're going to want real everything. And I think it's going to culminate in when virtual reality, if virtual reality ever takes off, and sort of cyber sex over the internet in sort of rubber jumpsuits, a synthetic experience of sex becomes readily available, and synthetic holidays as well, I think people are going to get very, very snobby about the fact, oh, we have real sex, we have real holidays in real places, we don't go for the cheap, mass-produced cyber version.
Jonathan Margolis covers new technology for the Financial Times and the Evening Standard. His book is called A Brief History of Tomorrow.